This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Please take a moment and listen with me to a speech made on the floor of the U.S. Congress on September 14th, 2001. This is the voice of Representative Barbara Lee.
This unspeakable act on the United States has really reforced me to rely on my moral compass, my conscience, and my God for direction. September 11th changed the world. Our deepest fears now haunt us. Yet I am convinced that military action will not prevent further acts of international terrorism against the United States. This is a very complex and complicated matter. Now, this resolution will pass, although we all know that the president can wage a war even without it. However difficult this vote may be, some of us must urge the use of restraint. Our country is in a state of mourning. Some of us must say, let's step back for a moment. Let's just pause just for a minute and think through the implications of our actions today so that this does not spiral out of control.
Representative Barbara Lee was the only member of Congress who voted against the 2001 authorization for use of military force. And she is with me now, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, who represents the 13th District of California and is the only African-American woman in Democratic Party leadership, serving as co-chair of the Policy and Steering Committee. Representative Lee, thank you for being here.
Nice being with you, Melissa.
So your 2001 speech has now gone viral in the world of social media. I wanted us to take a moment to listen to it because of the strength of both your intellectual argument and your emotional force in that moment. Can you help us to understand how you are thinking and feeling now, 20 years later, seeing the events in Afghanistan?
Well, Melissa, I have to tell you, 20 years later, in many ways, I'm feeling the same way. Because, first of all, we have been in Afghanistan 20 years. In many ways, we've occupied the country. And now the pain and the fear and the anxiety that so many have, I have, in terms of seeing what's taking place and the and at least how this transition and withdrawal has taken place. Also, you know, I worry about making sure that we get everyone out, the evacuation. It's going a bit more smoothly now. But the Afghan allies, our American citizens, our diplomats, women, children, we've got to do this in a way that makes sure that no one is left behind to be placed in harm's way as it relates to the brutal kinds of treatment of the Taliban. So I'm worried right now about that. And I want to make sure we have the resources for the special immigrant visas. And, you know, I chair the subcommittee on appropriations that funds a lot of what is taking place now. So I'm feeling the pain and the suffering of people who have been through so much and hoping that we've learned a lesson that there's no military solution in Afghanistan, and that feeling very reflective in terms of where we were and where we are today and how President Biden, thank God, has stated publicly over and over again that a military presence there was not going to achieve any type of national security goals other than being there for possibly another 20 years.
Are there circumstances when there is a military solution?
You know, I'm not a pacifist, Melissa, and you have to look at the threats. The president always has the authority to use force. The military option is on the table all of the time. And so we need to reassert Congress's responsibility in determining when the use of force is necessary. That's one of the problems I had on 9/14. It was a broad, overly broad, 60-word authorization that said that any president could use force anywhere in the world in perpetuity. that is really the set the stage for what I call forever war. And so Congress's Article 2 responsibility is to debate and determine where and when and if the president should have authority to use force. And that's how you make those determinations. But I also have to say that we have many tools of our foreign and military policy, diplomacy, development, and defense. That needs to be, those three aspects of foreign policy must be reordered and reimagined and reframed and reshaped now. Because we have a military budget, for example, of $740 billion, whereas my budget, which is the diplomacy and development aspect of our foreign policy, is about $62 billion. And so we have to rebalance this and say that, you know, global peace and security can only be achieved if, in fact, you engage in development and diplomacy, at least on par with our use of force in the military option.
So as you are describing that reordering of priorities and resources associated with those priorities, that sounds to me like kind of leadership 101, right? This is what leaders do. So I want to ask you a bit about leadership here. If people can kind of remember all the way back to the 2008 presidential primary, there were Democratic candidates who had to apologize for their vote to authorize the military use of force. President Obama did not, but of course he also was not in a position to have voted for it. I am interested in the fact that President Biden stood really strong and unapologetic on his position. He said that the buck stopped with him. On a broad leadership perspective, Representative, what is the value of leaders who are able to say they're wrong? And when have you been wrong?
Well, I think leaders must say in many ways that they're wrong when they're wrong and look at how to present that in an honest way to the public. I think people really do appreciate integrity. And even if they don't agree with you, you know, saying, well, I've rethought it. I'm not sure if, in fact, this is what the right decision was. But now we're here and we're going to develop a path forward based on what the new information or the new strategy should be. And I think that takes a heck of a lot. In many respects, you know, sometimes we cast votes that aren't necessarily the votes we would like to cast. There have been, and I'm trying to remember, certain votes that maybe because we had to move a bill forward, I was wrong in casting that vote, but I did it because I knew that the alternative was so bad that if I didn't do it, things would be worse. You know, the perfect can't be the enemy of the good. And that's some of the dilemmas I think that most of us in Congress have, is when there are key policy measures or key votes that you have to cast. Some bills don't go far enough for me, and tinker around the edges, but to just make some progress, you know, I'll vote for it and defend that. When, in fact, I know if the votes had been there, I would have voted a different way. And so those moments come with everybody. And you have to be clear with your constituents or with whomever that you cast a vote that you thought was not the correct vote, but things would have been worse had you not cast that vote. You know, it's that fine line. But when there are issues of moral conscience and issues of war and peace, and issues that really determine life or death, we have to stand firm on those issues.
I hear you describing a bit when you're saying sometimes there are bills that don't go as far as you like. I hear you describing one of the central challenges within the Democratic Party right now, the kind of, and maybe it's a bit overblown in media, but there is at least a little bit of a struggle here between maybe a more gradualist, somewhat more moderate perspective and a sort of swifter timeline, more, as we'll call it, progressive wing of the party. You're in leadership. How are you managing that?
Sure. It's my responsibility as a member of leadership, as an African-American, as a woman, as a progressive, to put those points of views and bring forward in our leadership meetings and in our strategies. It could be an alternative point of view, or it may be a consensus point of view. And so that's what's expected of me. So if I believe that, and if I'm with the caucuses that I belong to, I chair the caucus on poverty and opportunity. If I don't believe that this is going, any bill, for example, is not going to address systemic poverty, but leave so many people behind, a few people may benefit from it, then I speak up and try to negotiate and try to craft legislation that at least meets those bottom lines. And so, again, it's about being honest. It's about putting all of your cards on the table, making sure everyone knows where you're coming from. And it's not because it's you, but it's because you're reflecting the views of, again, the Congressional Black Caucus members, the Congressional Progressive Caucus members, our Women's Caucus. And you put all of that together. You synthesize it. You come up with agreement with every constituency that you're representing. And then you put that forward. And you have a seat at that table, as Shirley Chisholm said, and you don't go along to get along or play by all of the rules, because they naturally, all the rules weren't made for people of color, for African Americans. But you try to oftentimes change some of the rules so that perhaps those voices can be heard and the roadblocks aren't there. That's my job.
Now, some of that ideological struggle also plays out as a generational struggle. I think about some of the members of the squad, younger members, representatives who had to, you know, really sort of beat entrenched incumbents within the party in a hard fought primaries in order to secure their seats. Does the Democratic Party, it was often made a big issue of the Republican Party, but does the Democratic Party have a bench problem, a mentoring problem, or is the Democratic Party developing a new cadre of leaders?
I think we've seen over the years a new cadre of leaders. And every election now you see, especially women of color. We've had the first two Native American women, Democratic women, elected in the last 5 years. And I think that there's a bench. I know in my district and throughout members of the CBC's district, there are many, many young people who are prepared, because we prepare them. We have internship programs. They work with us on campaigns. They attend our boot camps. They do phenomenal work. I have my Martin Luther King Freedom Center, young people who traveled with me for 12 years with Congressman John Lewis on the Faith and Politics Institute. And so we mentor young people day and night. And I think you see new members, younger members, more progressive members being elected to Congress. And that's what securing the future is all about.
If you want to know more about Barbara Lee, the new documentary about Representative Lee premieres this Friday on Amazon Prime. Representative Barbara Lee of California, thank you for joining me today.
Nice being with you.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.